Thank you
so much. And you're not allowed to call me Dr. Moore. You have to call me Adam. Okay? Can we get that clear? All right. Very good.
Well, I'm really excited about this particular presentation because it forced me to reevaluate everything I think I know about surrender. And I actually like giving new presentations because it's more interesting for me because it makes me think about things. And that's my goal in life, is to grow and develop and not get stagnant. So this is great. So we're going to talk about now. This is really important. As I was preparing this, I was suddenly realizing that I named this presentation wrong, because I created a false dichotomy in the title. And that is as if letting go of responsibility for another person's recovery is opposite of or different than taking care of your own needs. So if I were to rename this presentation now, I would probably call it True Surrender. And I would say something like, letting go of responsibility for his recovery and taking care of your own needs. And, because this is not an either or. And this represents my own confusion about the process of surrender. And I think the confusion that a lot of people have about what true surrender actually is. So my goal is to help, at least from my perspective, my understanding, help you reevaluate what you believe about surrender. And I think this is going to be much more empowering than the type of surrender people tend to be doing. Okay? So we got to find out first, what is surrender? A lot of the wives I work with will come in and they'll say, I'm trying to figure out whether I should surrender this thing that's going on or whether I should really stand up and say, hey, this is kind of a big deal for me. And so I think a lot of people have that same false dichotomy, like as if surrender is just letting something go, acting like you don't care. Nah, I don't care about that. I'm fine. You know, when you do, when you very much care about it, it's almost as if you're trying to trick yourself into not caring about something that's a really big deal for you. And I don't think that's actually what surrender is. I think surrender is a lot less about letting go of things. And I don't like the idea of letting go, and even though I know 12-step, let go and let God, I get that. I don't like letting go because it feels like I'm losing something. And I don't want to lose something. Okay? It's just how I am. I want to gain something. So I like the idea of acceptance. Because when I accept, it means I'm getting something, picking something up. So to me, surrender is about accepting two things. The first one is accepting that my approach to getting my needs met is not working. My very best efforts at solving my own problems, getting what I want out of life, they're not working for me. I'm not being very effective. If you're in my last presentation, you'll know that is really important, effectiveness. And the second thing that we accept is influence from other people or power to help us do things that we cannot possibly do on our own. And I think surrender is important in every aspect of life, not just recovery. I think it's a key principle of human growth and development. A lot of American cinema, Western cinema, is about the lone gunman, the lone wolf, the one-man army who fights off thousands of people all on his own with some chewing gum and a toothpick, right? MacGyver style. If you were not, didn't live in the 80s, you have no idea what I'm talking about. You should look it up on YouTube. It's awesome. Okay? So, but one thing that there is common in more Eastern stories is the idea that there is a group of individuals. It maybe starts out as a single person, but comes to terms with the fact that the enemy is too great to handle on his or her own. And so they go about gathering strength and forces and strength in numbers. And it is only when they create this collectiveness, this group, to fight against the enemy that they can win. And I really, really like that concept. I think that really rings true for recovery. So in my mind, surrender is not about numbing out. It's not about disconnecting from your emotions to pretend like you're not upset about something. That is not surrender to me. It doesn't mean you're not going to feel emotion. You know, being fully surrendered doesn't mean that you're just totally zen about everything and I'm totally great. Nothing phases me. That's not surrender to me. And it certainly doesn't mean you have to lay down like a doormat and do whatever anybody else wants you to do. That is definitely not surrender. So true surrender is about accepting that you need transformation. You need to transform to help build a new self, that you cannot possibly do it on your own. My current self is not healthy enough to do what I need to do on my own. I'm incapable of transforming without help. That, in my mind, is surrender. Now, okay, prepare yourselves for this next slide. You cannot resist the sad dog face. Even if you don't like dogs, you can't resist the sad dog face. Okay, so this is really important because I think sometimes when people believe they are surrendering, they're actually succumbing to learned helplessness. And I want to help you differentiate because this is a really, really big deal. Okay, so Martin Seligman is a renowned scientist, researcher, psychologist, and today he's famous for positive psychology. But in the 1960s, he was doing some studies that are now quite famous. And one of them has to do with sad dogs, okay? Because back then we didn't have ethics, and we could just do, we had electric shock dogs, and that was okay, okay? So, in the mid-1960s, Seligman and other researchers placed dogs in special cages that had electrified floors on one half. The other half, they didn't have electrified floors. Some of the dogs were allowed to move about freely, and they would send shocks into this floor. And all of the dogs that were able to move about freely, the moment they got shocked, they got out of there. They jumped over to the other side where there were no shocks, and they escaped the shocks, right? Just makes sense. But some dogs were restrained, and they actually did not have the possibility of escaping shocks. And so eventually they realized that it doesn't matter how hard I move around or yelp or whatever I do, I'm going to get shocked. So they just laid down and took it. They might have whimpered a little bit, but they accepted the reality that life is full of electric shocks and there's just nothing I can do about it. Now, in the latter half of the experiment, Seligman and associates took these helpless dogs and gave them the opportunity to escape, just like the other group of dogs. In fact, it was quite easy. There was a small wall separating two halves of the cage, and all the dog would have to do is just stand up and jump over the wall to the other side, and that floor on the other side was not electrified, so they'd be safe. The majority, most of the dogs who had learned that life was full of electric shocks that you can do nothing about, even though there was an obvious way to escape, just kept taking the shocks. And in fact, researchers would try to show them that there was a way to get over there. They would, you know, do it themselves, and they'd show them the other dogs doing it. And they still kept sitting there getting electric shocks. Now, we won't go into this today, but really interestingly, what they found was that they actually had to physically take the dog's legs and put them in the position of jumping and actually move them over to the other side more than once, a few times before the dogs would finally go, oh, I can do that, and then they jump over to the other side. Now, there are so many cool recovery implications for that, but another presentation, maybe we can talk about that. So learned helplessness is the belief that regardless of my input, the output will always be the same. No matter what I do, I will never be effective at having influence or control over my life or over the outcome. The process, outcome, so there's no point in trying. That's the concept of learned helplessness. So some possible examples in recovery of learned helplessness might be when you decide that you should not be affected by other people's choices. That's, to me, that's learned helplessness, and that's not surrender. When you believe that you deserve your fate, this is probably my fault. If I were just better at whatever, then this wouldn't be happening. That's learned helplessness. That's not surrender. When you say, I'm going to commit to this relationship regardless of the cost, no matter what happens, to me, that is learned helplessness. It's not surrender. When you say, there's no point in making plans for the future, now this is really interesting. Because in recovery, we talk about living in the moment, right? But when you make no plans for the future whatsoever, when you believe that there's no point in thinking about tomorrow at all, I still think that's learned helplessness. And finally, when you believe that another person's actions create inevitable responses in you, that you have no choice but to respond the way you do. You don't have options. It's just a gut reaction, and that's how you're going to respond. To me, that's learned helplessness. That is not surrender. So, can you imagine being that guy out there? I don't know, but I'm terrified of heights, so that just looks really scary. I'll make myself feel better and assume he's only 20 feet off the ground instead of 10,000 or wherever he is right up there. I'm assuming his gender. That's probably inappropriate. Could be a woman, right? So, no woman is crazy enough to do that. Climb up there. One of the biggest challenges to doing surrender in recovery is to actually know whether you're surrendering or whether you're doing something else, whether I'm doing it right. And I don't want to get into this idea that you might be doing it wrong, but what I want to get into the idea here is that maybe there are different ways to approach surrender that will give you better results with less cost. Okay? So, for example, if you think you're doing surrender in a way that's healthy for you, but you're not totally sure, just your hesitance will minimize the power of that choice. I want you to be certain about the choices you make. Whatever choice you make, I want you to feel secure about it. Now, you can't be absolutely certain that this is the right thing to do. That's impossible. Nobody knows exactly. But I want to give you a framework, and that's what this is here. I want to give you a framework or a structure that you can use to help evaluate whether your process is stable, solid, healthy, so that you can have more confidence in the choices that you make. Because a lot of the questions I get from you are things like, was this the right thing to do? Or, I'm thinking about doing this, is that okay? Is that healthy? I think those are really good questions to be asking. And so I want to give you a framework so that you have a way to evaluate that. So, this is the first question you'll ask. Am I impaired? When I was in kindergarten, I was playing around, I think it was alone, on the playground, just sort of hanging out. And this like first or second grade girl came up to me. She was an older woman. And she said this phrase to me. Maybe you can finish it for me. Kindergarten baby. Born in the gravy. That's right. I don't know who made that up and how it got across the entire United States. That's amazing how that stuff happens. I'd never heard it before, and I was particularly incensed. My 6-year-old self was pretty upset. I knew I wasn't a baby, and I certainly was not born in the gravy. That much I knew. I didn't know much about the birds and bees. I don't remember gravy being involved, though. I felt pretty confident about that. So, I was pretty upset as a 6-year-old. I distinctly remember this experience. And so I remember sitting there thinking, okay, I need to come up with a way to validate my non-babiness and my complete separation from gravy. And so this was the plan I came up with as a 6-year-old. I looked around, I saw the monkey bars, and I thought, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to hang, kind of a dead weight hang, 2 hands from a monkey bar, and I'm going to defy the laws of physics and just propel my body forward to the next rung and grab on with both hands. And if I can do that, clearly I'm not a baby, because if you can defy the laws of physics, something cool has happened in your life. Okay? So, as you can imagine, I tried to jump, but I just fell. And I hit my head on a rock, and it was bleeding. And I don't remember what story I told, but I'm sure it was something to do with lions and sharks and stuff. But so at any rate, I did this. The reality is, I was impaired at the time. My decision-making capabilities were not intact. because I was so upset and I was trying to prove something, that I made a choice that had I been, you know, thought through it a little bit more, and I don't know how well six-year-olds can think through stuff, but I probably would have thought, I don't think this is going to help much. She's not even around. She's gone off somewhere else. Even if I do it, no one's going to see it, you know, so I can't prove I'm not a baby. I can say I did that, but no one will believe it. So I want you to evaluate whether you're impaired. Now, the thing that's going to cause the most impairment is trauma for you, because trauma sends people into a space of fight or flight, survival. And it's not your fault. You haven't done anything wrong. I've been rear-ended like 7 times, and I don't know why. I even got rear-ended in a drive-thru for fast food one time. How does that even happen, you know? And so I'm a little bit scared of like the 2x9 horror film that is my rearview mirror. Anybody that's coming up a little too fast, it's pretty scary for me, because I seem to be, I just attract getting rear-ended for some reason. So when we go into trauma, it's not, you know, it's not a choice. It's not something, okay, I'll just shut trauma off now. It impairs you. It makes it difficult to make rational decisions. Now, I'm not going to say, okay, turn off trauma and then make a good decision, because trauma is this sort of fluid thing that happens. But there are things that you can do to manage. And we won't talk too much about that. There was another presentation today on that, and we could talk another time. But the fact is that you want to evaluate this question, because you need to make good decisions. And if you're going to surrender, if you're going to evaluate whether what you're about to do is indeed surrender or not, being impaired is going to make that pretty tough. Now, the real challenge is, if you're impaired, it's hard to know you're impaired, right? That's the catch-22 of impairment, right? It's like someone who's taking medication and says, gosh, I'm feeling really good. I think I can get off my medication now. Nope. The reason you're feeling good is because you're on the medication. Don't get off the medication, right? And, you know, sometimes we can, but that happens a lot. People get off their meds because they think that they're fine now, but it's the meds that are helping them feel fine. So one thing that I would recommend you doing is practicing asking this question when the odds are not so serious, when the stakes aren't so high. You can ask yourself, like a parenting situation, right? Like, my child just peed on my brand new, really expensive wool rug. I'm just making this up. This didn't really happen to me or anything. That's last night. But anyway, that's a situation where, you know, your life's not in danger. You're not going to be experiencing, you know, trauma. You might be impaired, though, because you might be thinking, I want to throttle you, child. And so you might ask yourself, am I impaired right now? Am I going to make a good decision? Am I impaired by my intense emotionality about what's happening here? And do I need to take a little bit of a step back? So if you can practice in situations that are a little bit less serious, that will help you access that question later. And then ask other people. Don't ask the addict if you're impaired. Just so you know, he's not a good judge of whether you're impaired or not, because he's impaired. Okay? Because he's going to say, yes, of course you're impaired. Just do what I say and everything will be great. Okay? Ask other people. This is what a sponsor is for. This is what recovery partners, close family members that are, you know, emotionally stable and healthy and whatnot. You can say, am I thinking about this accurately? So that's your first question. Next question is, can I articulate my needs? Sometimes we just know something hurts and we just want to feel better, and that seems like the best need we can describe in the moment. I just want to feel better. I want the pain to go away. It's kind of hard to decide what you're wanting to do or to get help when you don't actually know what you need outside of, I just want the pain to go away. So I want to invite you to practice articulating needs. I'll give you some examples here that would expand on the idea of I just need to feel better. But also note that your needs are going to evolve over time. In my last presentation, I talked about early recovery. Needs are usually revolving around safety and sobriety, and in later recovery, they're around health promotion or growth, development as people. So your needs won't always be the same. You'll always need to feel safe, but you won't feel so intensely about safety when it's present for you most of the time or all of the time. So here's some examples of things you might articulate. I need to feel emotionally safe enough to take risks to be vulnerable in my relationships. This is why I never do marriage therapy in the early stages of addiction recovery, because marriage therapy, in its sort of classic sense, requires vulnerability. But you can't ask someone to be vulnerable. You can't ask a woman to be vulnerable with a man who's in the middle of lying to her and betraying her and treating her terribly. You can't do that because all you're going to do is increase trauma. So it's a mistake when people who are trying to help say, you know, if you just would go on a date every Friday, everything would be great, right? No, it wouldn't be great. In fact, it's going to be worse because we're acting like we're okay when we're clearly not. So that's one example. Here's another example. I need some time each day to take care of myself in a meaningful way without feeling guilty. Because heaven forbid that you do something for yourself before everybody else on the earth is taken care of first. And you feel that. A lot of the women I work with say that. They say, I don't feel like it's okay for me to take care of myself because there's something that's out there that's supposed to be happening. There's a child that needs homework done. There's, you know, whatever. There's something. And if I take care of myself, then I'm being selfish. Okay? And there is a difference. There's a big difference between self-care and selfishness. You want to know what the difference is? Okay? The difference is selfishness does not regard how the behavior affects other people. Okay? And you probably won't have that problem. Because you worry about how your behavior affects other people. It's just how you are. So the likelihood is most of the time that's not going to be your particular issue. Your particular issue most of the time, and this isn't true for everybody in the room, but most of the time your particular issue is how do I rid myself of the guilt that I feel when I take care of myself, and the voice I hear in my head, it might be mom or dad or husband or somebody saying, you're so selfish for eating food or for bathing yourself. How dare you? Something like that. And it's true because I have women that come to me and they say, I only take a shower once a week because I don't even have time to do that. Without 50 people running in the room and trying to yell at me through the glass, stuff that they need from me, right? That's what locks are for, people. So, another example would be, I need to be able to tell the truth as I see it without being afraid of relational repercussions. I want to be able to tell my husband or my child or whatever what I'm really feeling without feeling like everything's going to explode. And a lot of women will do that. They'll say, things are going so well. I have this thing bugging me, but I really want to say it, but I'm afraid it's going to mess up how things are going, so I better just be quiet. And that is a problem. Okay, yes?
Can you repeat the end of that first?
The last part? I need to be able to tell the truth one?
Yeah.
I need to be able to tell the truth as I see it without being afraid of relational repercussions. Okay? A big fight. The next one is, I need to be able to seek support from others and feel confident that they will respond to me. Okay, that's really important. And similarly, I need to be able to respond to others in ways that I feel confident about. I have a lot of women that will tell me, I don't know that I could ever be a sponsor in 12-step because I don't have it all figured out. So how can I sponsor someone if I'm not perfect, right? Or something like that. How can I sponsor someone if I don't know all of the answers? You don't need to know all the answers to sponsor someone. You just have to be confident that you can tell the truth and be supportive and be emotionally stable and sponsor people like that. You don't have to know everything. Okay? I need to trust that I'm not responsible for another person's recovery. That's really hard. It's really hard to do. Especially when that other person is trying to make you responsible for their recovery and is shaming you for not being responsible for their recovery. When you're emotionally sensitive, there are lots of little things that can be what I call hooks that hook you, drag you back in to the old way of being. All right. So as you're thinking about surrender, you're thinking about giving up the old you in place of a new you. So I want you to ask yourself, I'm articulating my needs. What do I need to give up? Which parts of me do I need to let go of and replace? And who can help me do that? You're not going to do it on your own. If you could do it on your own, you would have already done it by now. And you wouldn't be asking yourself a question. Okay. Am I being true to my core self? This is a bit philosophical. I believe that a key part of especially early recovery for the women I work with whose spouses or partners are addicts is to find a healthy voice in a relationship. And many have lost their voices, or their voices have become tainted, become something that they're not comfortable with anymore. Some examples would be the perpetual peacemaker or the rescuer voice, the persecutor voice. If I help you to experience my pain vicariously enough, maybe you'll get it. That's what I think people are doing when they're persecuting. I don't think it's sadistic. I think it's just like, I can't pound empathy into your head, but I'm going to try. Right? I'm going to try to get you to feel as much pain as I'm feeling, so maybe you'll stop doing this. Because what rational human being would inflict this much pain on a person and just think it was totally fine? Or the absent voice. I say nothing. I let everything go. And I want to help the women I work with find a healthy voice. Now, this is where it gets interesting with surrender, because what I often hear from people is things like, well, my spouse was just acting like a real jerk and I just had to surrender it. And something about that's not working for me. Now, maybe that is the case for you sometimes. Maybe the right thing for you to do is to say, I'm just not touching this one today because I don't want to drain my energy on this. It's not worth it to me. But maybe that's not always the right thing for you. You have to ask yourself, which parts about myself have been hurting me? So if I had an absent voice, then maybe I'm surrendering to the absent voice and saying, I can never beat you, absent voice. You will win every time. But with the help of friends and God, people that understand and know, I can speak up. So maybe when you speak up, that actually is true surrender, which is different than a lot of people think when they think about surrender. It's surrendering the part of you that's not taking care of you. The thing that I really like about the concept of surrender that I was reading about this past week that I was trying to wrap my head around was they kept saying, I kept reading these articles about surrender, and they kept saying you need to surrender to that thing. And I was like, nah, that doesn't make any sense. But what they're saying is you need to surrender to your own weakness. I give up. I cannot fight you, weakness, on my own. I give up trying to win the battle on my own. So I will seek support to do what I need to do. So yes.
Which is confront the issue.
If what you need to do is to confront the issue instead of taking it out on the vulnerable parties in the home, which are the kids, and it's really, really common to do that. You don't intend it. But it's just so easy to do because they'll take it and they'll love you. Then you need to surrender to the part of you that doesn't speak up and say, you win. You win. I will never win against you. So I will seek help to stand up for myself. And so sometimes in therapy, the wives I work with will come in and say, is it okay to say this to my husband? And I'll say, yeah. And it's the first time they've ever heard someone give them permission to stand up for themselves. You know, because maybe their mom says, just keep the peace, or whatever it is. So they stand up for themselves. So this won't always work, but I'll give you a little bit of a hint here on how you might do it. Take your immediate, instant gut reaction to something. Question it. And ask yourself, is this gut reaction, is this really helping me get my needs met? Is this what I really want to do, or do I need to surrender to this part of myself? Because often our instant gut reaction is the part of us that's undermining. It's about betraying yourself. Okay? Because your core self, the very deep core you that has been tainted by trauma and maybe abuse and neglect and just life, that core self is healthy. That core self knows what she needs, has a sense of self-worth, is capable, is confident. But life has a way of making you forget all that. I really believe that. And the deep down, whatever you want to call it, a soul or a essence or whatever, knows. That's why people practice intuitive eating. I'm going to trust myself. I'm going to trust my body to know what I need to eat. Yes. How about we use the word anger? Resentment is usually permission giving. Resentment is a way that you give yourself permission. I'll repeat the question. What if your core self is resentful? I would say your core self can be angry. Because anger, there's nothing wrong with anger. Anger is just a signal that something's wrong. Usually anger is a signal that you're being violated in some way. So anger is actually rather helpful and quite healthy. Not all the ways that we deal with anger are. So your core self may be very angry because you've been violated over and over and over again. And that anger is telling you, I have a right to stand up for myself. I think so. To me, I get nervous about resentment, especially as it pertains to addicts, because addicts use resentment to give themselves permission to balance the ledger. Something's not fair, and life is supposed to be fair, because that's what my mom and dad showed me, by cutting the cake exactly down the middle. And so, life's not fair, and therefore, I have to balance this. I've got to balance the ledger, and the only way I can think of doing it is by doing something sneaky that no one knows about. It makes no sense. But there you go. But there you go. That's how it's done. So, yeah, I think real emotion, including anger, frustration, sadness, I think that can all be part of the core self. Because emotion is neither good nor bad, it's just information. Okay? So, remind me what time this is over. Let's see if we've missed anything on this. If you want to explore, now, you can only be true to your core self if you actually know your core self. And the way that you're going to do that is you're going to have to do some exploration. You've either lost sight of it, or your trauma started so early on that you never really learned who you were. So things like your values, right, things that matter to you, your talents, even your weaknesses can be part of your core self. Wrap your head around that. Okay, hopes and dreams. The ways you identify or connect with others, your individual uniqueness. That is your core self. And so you have to ask yourself, am I being true to or am I betraying my core self? Next question is, have I slowed down enough? I would say most of my poor decisions in life, at the root of them, have been making too quick of a decision. Impulses, just thinking, oh, I'm sure this will be fine, that kind of stuff. So, now we live in a world that doesn't really value going slowly, right? You've got too many soccer games to go to and piano lessons, and maybe you're in school, and maybe you work. Maybe you need to actually take a shower every so often. Okay? And it is very hard to slow down. But to me, slowing down is the gift that you give to both yourself and those that rely on you for support, like your children. Because if you can give yourself enough time to make better decisions, then every decision you make with regard to yourself and others is going to be better than if you tried to run and gun and make it as quick as you can and move on to the next thing. Give yourself a chance to slow down. Now, I will say this. On some level, addicts like it when you're not slowing down, because it's predictable. And when you're in the limbic system and making decisions and rash decisions, they go, cool, I know how to manipulate this. I can get right back to where things are that I like. So one of the most terrifying things you can do for an addict is to say, you know, normally I would do this, but I'm going to slow down and think about this. I need a couple of days to decide how I'm going to respond to you. That is petrifying for addicts. Because they're like, what's she going to do? She's never done this before. This is weird. I bet now I have to panic for 3 days while she's deciding what she's going to do. I can't control this. Okay? So it's actually a wonderful tool. Say, I've got to think about this one because I know what I'd normally do and I'm not comfortable with what I normally do. I don't like it. I'm not sure how I'm going to respond, but I will let you know. When I do let you know, there won't be any room for conversation about it. It's just what I'm going to do. Okay? That's powerful. I've heard that called the wait and see boundary. I'm setting up a boundary that I'm not going to instantly react. I'm going to wait and see what I'm going to do. I'm going to wait and see what you're going to do while I'm waiting and seeing what I'm going to do. Okay, just wrap your head around that one. When I started working at BYU, I noticed that the director of the clinic where I am, we'd be in meetings, and every time he's about to say something important, he would breathe deeply. He'd close his eyes sometimes, and then he'd say it. And I knew when he breathed, something important was about to come out of his mouth. And so I've actually adopted that as a practice with my clients and just in my life in general. If I need to say something important, I'm going to breathe first. Okay. Now I'm ready to say it, right? And it really makes a difference. If you slow down, you get more time to make the decisions you really want to make. You can evaluate the possible outcomes. Okay, if I do this, here's what might happen. Here's how I'm going to respond. You're going to take me down the line. He might do this, and then I'm going to do this. And you think ahead. And you can send a clear message. I'm not ruled by trauma. I make proactive decisions. I'm deliberate in my decision making. I think that's a great message to send. Now, question number whatever. Do I have enough resources? So these would be resources like emotional resources. Am I emotionally drained or do I have resources? Do I have enough physical resources? Am I managing my food intake, my sleep, okay, my exercise, am I taking care of my body? Do I have enough spiritual resources? Do I feel connected enough to God or to other people? That I'm not feeling isolated. The research shows time and time again that if you've got sufficient resources, you're going to make better decisions. You will make better decisions. And so ask yourself, am I taking care of myself well enough? Now, this is tough because sometimes when you're living with a particularly difficult addict, life is just full of craziness all the time. And it's hard to slow down and think about anything, and you're lucky to, you know, eat a granola bar for lunch or whatever. So this is where you get to set some boundaries for yourself. Carve out time. I need to manage my resources better so that when I make decisions, I feel confident about them. Last night was relatively late, and I was still putting the finishing touches on these presentations. And I wanted to practice more, and I just thought, I can't do it. I need to get more sleep than I'm going to get if I keep practicing. And it's not going to benefit me or anyone else if I practice really good all through the night and then I'm a zombie when I'm presenting. Okay, it's not going to go well. So I've got to trust my own process. And now, finally, what truth do I want to establish about myself? If you're in my motivation presentation, you'll know that there's a strong human desire to establish truth effectiveness. We want to know that we're capable of knowing the difference between what is true and what is not true. It motivates human beings to do things. And when we make decisions to surrender, we can establish certain truths about ourselves as we surrender. Okay? So, some examples might be, I'm able to handle traumatic experiences in a healthy way. So I'm going to surrender the old me that would curl up in a ball for 3 days. I'm not going to do that anymore. I surrender to that old me, and I'm going to invite the new me with the help of God and my sponsor and my friends and family to do something different. I have a right to express difficult emotions to my spouse or whoever the addict is in my life. And you establish that truth by doing it. And if normally you don't do it, then you surrender to the self that doesn't do it and you invite the new self in that does.
Can you say that one again?
Yes. I have a right to express difficult emotions to the addict, usually. Or to anybody. How about your parent? How about your parent who keeps telling you that you just need to forgive and move on and make your marriage better and be a better wife, or whatever your mom is telling you or your dad or whatever. It happens all the time. Sometimes you need to say to them, you're not helping me. What you're saying isn't helping, and I've spent my whole life being afraid to tell you that, but I'm going to tell you now. Okay? And you may not like the new me, but I like the new me. And the new me is going to do things differently. I can be strong in the face of the addict's unhealthy reactions to me. Surrendering doesn't always mean backing off. It doesn't always mean walking away. Sometimes surrendering means standing up, saying, no, I will not take that. I'm worth more than that. I'm more valuable than to sit here and accept this type of behavior. I surrender to the old self who can't do it on her own. And I invite a new self who can, with the help of others and God. Standing up for myself is not wrong or bad. You establish truth effectiveness. It is true that I can stand up for myself and I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not breaking rules. Or if I am breaking rules, they're dumb rules. And they deserve to be broken. They're rules my dad made up or something, and he doesn't have good rules. I can trust God. My needs actually matter. And finally, I don't have to control the outcome to be okay. I'm not going to die. I'll often tell my kids this. They'll be crying hysterically over something. And I'll say, are you going to die? No? Okay, then slow down. Okay, and let's talk about this. But if you're not going to die, then maybe we need to stop screaming like we're going to die. Okay? Now, I can't tell you which parts about yourself that you need to surrender. It's different for every person. You can't even rely on your sponsor to tell you which parts you need to surrender. You can rely on a therapist or a sponsor or a trusted colleague to point you in the right direction, to give you some feedback, to help you start thinking about it. But I want you to learn to trust yourself, not necessarily everybody else all the time. You need to eventually come to trust yourself. I've gone through the process, I've asked the questions, I feel confident about where I am, and I can trust the decision that I'm going to make now. And that's establishing truth effectiveness. I can make good decisions, and I don't need other people to validate them all the time. That's a cool place to land. So I want you to take, again, I'll come back to this, take what you normally do, how you normally respond, and ask yourself, is this really helping me? Is my normal reaction and response really helping, or is this just keeping me stuck? And can I change this on my own? If I can't, who can help me? And sometimes surrender, true surrender, is standing up for yourself, refusing to back down. Refusing to back down on issues that are important to you. Sometimes it may not feel like true surrender, but sometimes you're surrendering the old self, and you stand up and you say, I will not take this anymore. I am worth more than this. Because you're surrendering that part of yourself that really doesn't believe that you deserve better. Thank you. Now, we have 5 minutes.